Christianity has produced some true geniuses across history, and so far we have covered quite a few of them, such as Thomas Aquinas, the Pseudo-Dionysius, and Meister Eckhart, among others. But in my opinion, one of the most interesting and unique thinkers in the Christian, especially Catholic, tradition comes quite late in history. One who straddles the lines between the medieval world and the Renaissance and even modern periods, having been called the first modern thinker by some scholars, and who wrote about God and our knowledge of the divine in ways that hadn't really been seen before and which has rarely been replicated since. His name was Nicolaus Cusanus, or Nicholas of Cusa, a 15th century Catholic cardinal, bishop, philosopher, and mystic whose teachings on learned ignorance and other topics are some of the most baffling in the Christian intellectual tradition. So, in honor of the Christmas season, let's take a look at the life and works and thought of the great Nicholas of Cusa. Nicholas was born in 1401 in Germany, specifically in a town called Kues, which is Latinized as Cusa. He was from a modest family, his father being a ferryman and boat owner, and he grew up mostly in this region of Germany. Kues, or Cusa, being located in western Germany, close to the Rhine, Nicholas could be, and often is, considered among the so-called Rhineland mystics, alongside figures like Eckhart and his followers, even though Nicholas lives a bit later on in history, of course. His life essentially spans the 15th century pretty neatly, and was indeed a very eventful and dramatic life. At an early age, he enrolled in universities in the region to study the liberal arts, but eventually went especially deeply into canon law. Now, canon law is basically the rules and laws that are applied within the structure of the church itself, and this became Nicholas's kind of specialty. This was his area of expertise, where he became a doctor eventually. He got a doctorate in this and began teaching canon law as well. In 1425, still in his 20s, he came to the University of Cologne as a doctor of canon law and taught the subject there. But Nicholas's scope of interest was really very large, and he studied and mastered many fields within philosophy, theology, and science. He became essentially a polymath, or a Renaissance man, as it would become known later on in history, right? Because he was interested in and really mastered so many different fields, not just theology and church matters, so to say, but also things like mathematics and science. He was very interested in and deeply read in mathematics, and he made some acquaintances, and he became close friends at his time in Cologne and Italy and so on with some of the most brilliant mathematicians of that time. It's probably during his years in the University of Cologne that he also encountered the writings and ideas of figures like Pseudo-Dionysius, Ramon Llull, and Meister Eckhart, and all of this would come to play a significant role in his own writings. As you will see when we explore his philosophy, the fact that he was a kind of maybe amateur mathematician really comes to play an important role in how he conceives of and how he talks about God and the divine and our knowledge of the divine in really interesting and fascinating ways. But soon, Nicholas also became directly involved with the church and the papacy. In 1431, he attended the Council of Basel in Switzerland, where he represented Ulrich von Manderscheid and his claim to the bishopric. But there was also a lot of trouble and turmoil in the church at the time, and through his connections with the council, Nicholas became quite involved with questions of church reform and church leadership in different ways. You see, by this time, the papacy and Catholic Church was going through quite a rough period. They had just come out of a period known as the Western Schism, when the church was split in terms of who they considered to be the legitimate pope, with all the political aspects that also that brought with it. A period that lasted between 1378 and 1417. Now, during this period, there was one pope in Rome and another one in Avignon, both claiming to be the legitimate one. At one point in 1409, there was even another split so that there were three simultaneous popes at the same time. So this is quite a messy situation, right? This was a quite unique and even traumatic event that still reverberated in the 1430s when Nicholas became involved in church affairs. One result of this turmoil was the rise in popularity of something known as conciliarism, which was a movement that essentially argued that supreme authority rested with an ecumenical council, the one that Nicholas became a part of, rather than with the Pope exclusively, and that the decisions of this council could even override the decision of the decisions of the Pope, right? That the Pope was had to abide by the ultimate decisions of this council in some way, right? And Nicholas, at first in his career, seems to have been a conciliarist, right? He supported that side of the debate. Now, he arguably wasn't as extreme of a conciliarist as many maybe are led to believe. He did believe that decisions lay in this council, ultimately, but the Pope and his opinion was also part of this council, right? So it's a bit more complicated than what is sometimes presented, but still, he began as a conciliarist, but then there was a quite dramatic turn. The Pope Eugene IV wanted, in 1436, to move the council from Basel to Ferrara in Italy. One of the reasons for this was that they wanted to try to unite the Western Church with the Greeks, or the Orthodox, so to say, in a joint East-West Council to help fight off the looming threat of the Muslim Ottomans that were approaching Constantinople at that time, right? They were really looking like they were going to try to conquer the city. The majority of the council opposed this idea of moving the council, but Nicholas was one of the few in minority who actually supported it. And when this caused a serious rift in the council, Nicholas eventually ended up becoming a papist, working closely with the Pope for the rest of his life. The first mission that he went on for the papacy was in July of 1437, when he and two bishops were sent to Constantinople to meet with the Greeks and discuss this joint council, and then to bring some of those Greeks back with him to Italy. And this trip would turn out to be very significant for Nicholas and set the trajectory for much of his life. Not only did his journey to the East probably instigate a passion for ecumenism between different churches and the differences between rites and sects, but he also probably came into contact with the Muslims more directly during this trip, and with even with the Quran, it seems, to some degree, right? So he became familiar with that, and that would also turn out to be important for his later works and later writings. He refers to the Quran as the law book of Muhammad, and it seems that this is the time when he's in Constantinople that he's really exposed to this book, the scripture, and the Muslim faith in general. But perhaps even more significantly was what happened on the return journey back from the East. Here, while he was traveling at sea to return home to Italy, he had some kind of vision or insight which suddenly allowed him to understand and to put into words what he had been unable to say for many years prior. He himself writes about this event, quote, "Accept now, Reverend Father, what for so long I desired to attain by different paths of learning, but previously could not until returning by sea from Greece, when, by what I believed was a celestial gift from the Father of Lights, from whom comes every perfect gift, I was led to embrace incomprehensibles incomprehensibly in learned ignorance, by transcending those incorruptible truths that can be humanly known. This learned ignorance I have, in the one who is the truth, now set loose in these books, which on the basis of this same principle can be compressed or expanded." This experience was in fact the instigating factor for Nicholas composing what has become undoubtedly his most famous work, De Docta Ignorantia, or On Learned Ignorance, in which he also presents those most famous of his philosophical ideas, like that of the title, the learned ignorance, as well as the coincidence of opposites. We'll return to these properly more later on. Needless to say, his close relationship with the Pope and his brilliant scholarship allowed him to rise in the ranks of the Church. He became a priest, and then a few years later, in 1448, he was ordained a cardinal by Pope Nicholas V. In other words, holding what was essentially one of the highest positions in the Church. Subsequently, he was also appointed bishop in Germany and was in charge of spearheading reform in that region. Over all these years, in the 1450s and early 60s, he continued writing prolifically while also carrying out intense work for the Church, for some periods traveling almost constantly while giving sermons and attending councils. The fact that he was able to produce so many texts, and texts that were also so complex and deep, you know, with the schedule that he had, is actually quite impressive. Much of his work as bishop in the 1450s was actively opposed by Duke Sigismund of Austria, though, with whom he had a kind of constant beef for the rest of his life. Sigismund imprisoned Nicholas and would always work against him, so much so that Nicholas returned to Rome after 1460, where he spent his final years. He doesn't seem to have been especially happy here in Rome either, though. He was caught up in political conflicts and petty squabbles. He felt that the system was corrupt and morally bankrupt. Being a man passionate about reform, he seems to have been frustrated with being caught in the web of the corruption that he wanted to oppose, on top of increasing personal health problems as well. He tried to resign to Pope Pius by saying some very dramatic and kind of vulnerable words, quote, "I cannot do it. I do not know how to flatter. I hate adulation. If you can bear to hear the truth, I like nothing which goes on in this curia. Everything is corrupt. No one does his duty. Neither you nor the cardinals have any care for the church. What observance of the canons is there? What reverence for laws? What assiduity in divine worship? All are bent on ambition and avarice. If I ever speak in a consistory about reform, I am laughed at. I do no good here. Allow me to withdraw. I cannot endure these ways. I am an old man and need rest. I will return into seclusion, and since I cannot live for the commonweal, I will live for myself." A quite genuine and sad plea from such a legendary figure, right? He really wears his heart on his sleeve here and really seems to be in quite a lot of emotional pain from his situation. Despite this, however, the Pope, Pius, still kind of convinced him to stay, because, you know, he had a lot of responsibilities and duties that were required of him, and that the church also kind of, relied on him to some degree for some of those things. So he did end up staying in Rome until his death in 1464. This was, of course, a very brief overview of his final years, but you can see that he lived a very dramatic and eventful life. He was even a witness to, although not an eyewitness, right? But still, he lived through and saw from a distance the conquest of Constantinople in 1453 by the Ottomans, which was a kind of, at least symbolically, right, a kind of cataclysmic event for Christianity. And this would also very much affect not just the church, of course, but him too, and result in some of his writings. And the response that he had to that event is really interesting, and that we're also going to get to that a bit later on. And that's precisely where we're going to turn next, namely to what did he actually write, and what was the philosophy and theology, maybe, that he presents in his many and very unique, complex works. Nicholas of Cusa wrote a lot of works. Throughout the 1440s, 50s, and 60s, he produced profound and influential texts that are some of the most unique and baffling in the history of Christianity. The scholar Professor David Albertson divides his creative output into three phases, neatly fitting into the three decades, basically, where he focused on different topics or aspects of his thought. In the first, in the 1440s, he wrote works relating to the ideas of learned ignorance and the coincidence of opposites, essentially works that expanded in unique ways on the method of negative or apophatic theology. Important works in this era, in this period, include the most famous on learned ignorance, a work called On Conjectures and On the Hidden God. In the middle period of the 1450s, the focus is more on direct experiencing and ways of seeing God, and includes the so-called Idiota de Mente series, The Layman on Mind. There's also De Pace Fidei, On the Peace of Faith, a work on ecumenism and religious tolerance and unity that he wrote in response to the conquest of Constantinople. And another one of his most famous and popular works, the beautiful De Visione Dei, On the Vision of God, talking about the nature of seeing or experiencing God and what that actually means. And in the final period, in the 1460s primarily, he wrote many of his works focusing on naming God and how to talk about God, where he makes some significant creative innovations on what to call the divine, including De Possessed, on the possessed or can is, De Non Aliud, or on the not other, as well as composing what is essentially a Christian commentary on the Quran called Cribratio al Qurani, Sifting the Quran. Now, to summarize Cuza's philosophy or thought is quite a daunting task, maybe even an impossible task. So as always in these videos, we're going to have to pick and choose a few important points or topics that he brings up and try to give as good of an overview of those particular subjects as we can. And a natural place to start, perhaps, is to look at what is, again, arguably his most famous work, which is On Learned Ignorance. And the key theme of that book, which is, as you might have guessed, the theme of learned ignorance. But to begin with, Nicholas can be considered a Christian Neoplatonist, in the sense that he is clearly inspired by the writings of figures like Pseudo-Dionysius, as well as having access to and studying the direct writings of ancient Platonists like Proclus, and we see traces of their thought in his writings. On top of this, he can also be considered within a similar school of thought to his Christian predecessor Meister Eckhart and his successors. At the same time, it must be stated that Nicholas is very unique, and even though we can see influence from these earlier thinkers, he takes their teachings and ideas into completely new avenues sometimes, so that we can certainly not just write him off as copying what they did. But having a basic understanding of the philosophical background is helpful, and so hence I recommend anyone listening who wants to go a bit deeper to go and revisit some of my earlier episodes on figures like Pseudo-Dionysius and Meister Eckhart to really appreciate what Nicholas of Cusa is doing here. There are so many things that we could bring up here, as I said, but maybe let's start with the most famous and arguably foundational aspect of his thought, which is his view on God, what God is and the implications that that has. And essentially, the key aspect of how he conceived of God is as the absolute maximum. The maximum, which is that which is all that it can possibly be. This might seem pretty basic and harkens back to like Anselm's famous ontological argument, but Cusa is doing a lot more than this. He talks about the concept of the maximum most extensively and famously in On Learned Ignorance, where he says, quote, "I call maximum that beyond which there can be nothing greater. Fullness, of course, is fitting and proper to what is one. Thus, unity, which is also being, coincides with maximumness, and if such unity is completely free from all relation and contraction, it is clear that because it is absolute maximumness, nothing is opposed to it. Accordingly, the maximum is the absolute one that is all things, and all things are in this maximum, for it is the maximum. And because the maximum has no opposite, the minimum coincides with it as well, and therefore the maximum is also in all things. Because it is absolute, it is actually all possible being and contracts nothing from things, for all things come from it. This maximum, which also the indubitable faith of all nations believe to be God, I will, for the first book, endeavor to investigate incomprehensibly above human reason by the guidance of the one who alone dwells in inapproachable light. The maximum is God, and is one, unified, infinite, and eternal, which is obvious, perhaps. If something is maximum and all that it can be, it can't be limited or it wouldn't be maximum, since it would be lacking something. But as we can see from the quote, this also leads to the inevitable conclusion that there is nothing that the maximum can't be. God is all there is. It is all things, and all things are in the maximum. We're thus dealing with a kind of non-dualism, perhaps, even though I don't like to use that word here, since it doesn't really capture the scope of what he's saying here. But this will be a recurring theme through all the discussions we have here. If God is the maximum, which he defines as that which is all that it can possibly be, it cannot be distinct from anything, because if it was different from any one thing, it would be limited by not being that thing, and thus it wouldn't be maximum anymore. But this is no crude pantheism either, because at the same time, God or Maximum is also nothing. It's no thing. It can't be identified with anything in the universe, because if it was that thing, it would be that thing in distinction from anything that is other than that thing, and thus it wouldn't be Maximum anymore. So God is both all things and none of them at the same time. But there was another very interesting point hiding in that quote, namely that the absolute Maximum is also the absolute minimum. God is that beyond which there can be nothing greater, but God is also that beyond which there could be nothing smaller. This may seem paradoxical, but it gets us to another one of his central themes, and possibly the one that he is most famous for, the coincidence of opposites. This is essentially an attack on the law of non-contradiction, a principle traced to Aristotle that is foundational and central to basically all logic and reason deduction, that we can't contradict ourselves. Essentially, if we're making a logical argument, then we shouldn't contradict ourselves, because then logic falls apart. It's a very basic notion in all logic. What Kuza says here is that this is a flawed perspective, because when it comes to God, when it comes to the Maximum, the infinite, contradictions fall apart and coincide. The absolute Maximum must also be the absolute minimum. From the perspective of infinity, these opposites coincide. Quote, "The simply and absolutely Maximum, that which there cannot be anything greater, is greater than we can comprehend, for it is infinite truth. Therefore, we can attain it only incomprehensibly, because it is not of the nature of those things that admit a greater and a lesser, it is above all that we can conceive. Moreover, all that can be apprehended by the senses, reason, or intellect are so different in themselves and from each other that there is no precise equality among them. Therefore, Maximum equality, which is neither other than or different from anything, surpasses all understanding. Since the absolutely Maximum is all that it can be, it is completely actual. And just as there cannot be a greater, so for the same reason, there cannot be a lesser, since it is all that it can be. But the minimum is that than which there cannot be a lesser. Because the Maximum is also of this sort, it is obvious that the minimum coincides with the Maximum." It is when he explains this coincidence of opposites that he employs mathematics and geometry to argue his point. Infinity, or the Maximum, is represented by a straight line, and he argues, for example, that a curved line, like that of a circle, coincides with its opposite, straightness, in infinity. So imagine like this. If you have a circle where the lines are naturally curved, now imagine that the circle that you have becomes bigger and bigger, and eventually that curved line will appear more and more straight, the more you kind of zoom in, or the bigger this circle becomes. Now go even further and imagine then that the circle is infinitely large, and it will indeed only be a straight line at that point. Thus the opposites have coincided in infinity. Similarly, if you take that circle and make it smaller and smaller, so the opposite, eventually that circle will only become a single point. And a single point is identical to a single point on an infinite straight line. Any line is just the spatial extension of a single point, so once again, they have coincided. He also uses the shape of a triangle to make the same point. So if you take a triangle, which is defined by its angles, and you can expand those angles infinitely, eventually it too becomes a straight line. Thus, every shape or line is ultimately just the straight line. That is their reality, without the straight line ever changing into the curved one, and so on. It's a quite brilliant way of arguing his point, and of showing that when it comes to God, all such rational conceptions and paradoxes fall apart, or rather they unite or coincide. And this is essentially the reason why he comes to the conclusion that is named in the title of the work, Learned Ignorance. It was true, as Socrates said, that I only know that I know nothing, because the only way to truly know God is to be ignorant. To realize that any form of knowledge as we know it is limited and will never get us to God, since he is beyond all concepts and words. This might be very familiar to you and might just sound like he's following his mystical predecessors in applying what is known as negative theology, or also as apophatic theology, or apophasis in Greek. And this is true, this is essentially what he's doing, and he is very clearly here in a tradition, a line of thinkers that goes back to like the late Platonists, the Neoplatonists, like Plotinus and Proclus, who are often said to be the originators of many of these ideas, or at least ways of talking about it. This very apophatic language very much comes from them. But also, and in the case of Cusa, maybe even more so, specifically also taking from the earlier Christian predecessors that were in turn also influenced by the Neoplatonists, like we mentioned before, like Pseudo Dionysius, Meister Eckhart, maybe Gregory of Nyssa, and these kinds of people, right? So it's very clear that he's getting this this concept from them. And what negative or apophatic theology is essentially this idea that nothing, no words, no concepts, no thoughts, no conceptions can ever describe God. We can never understand God with our mind and the concepts of our mind. Neither can we ever describe God with words. If anything, the only thing we can do, if we can do anything at all, is to describe God by saying what God isn't. Right? God is not limited, God is not, and so on. And this is why it's called negative theology, because it's based on negative statements. It's saying what God is not. Right? We can never say what God actually is, because anything we say about God, it will limit God to that thing or that concept, as opposed to other concepts, and or divide God into parts, and so, right, so it just doesn't work. So he very much is in this, he follows this tradition of thinking about God. But Cusa is also expanding on this idea in some ways. This learned ignorance is, of course, different from simple, regular ignorance. We should not read these thinkers as saying that reason is useless and that we are better off not learning anything at all in life, or that we should just, you know, rely on faith in the modern sense that is sometimes used. Instead, it is the learned in learned ignorance that is the key here. The Latin term is docta ignorantia, and docta can also mean a taught ignorance, which maybe gets closer to what he means here. What Cusa and others are doing is using reason, and even mathematics, as we saw, to explore the very limits of the intellect, to recognize that God is so beyond our limited modes of conceiving the world that we can never get to God in that way. Indeed, Cusa is arguably even more radical by saying that we can't really know anything about anything in the world, truly. All we do when we know things is that we distinguish them from other things. So when we know a car, what we're doing is we're defining that car based on what it isn't. So I know that it's a car because it's different from that tree or from that person. And we can distinguish between different cars based on their color or their shape or their location in space and time. Right, so all our knowledge is based on negation, on saying this is different from that, but we never know the actual essence of things as they are, only what they're not. Right? You see the idea. Partly, of course, because the essence of the thing, whatever that thing is in the world, will ultimately be God, God's self, the maximum that has become unfolded or contracted into that thing. This is what he talks about in the second and third parts of Unlearned Ignorance. While God is the absolute maximum, the universe is the contracted maximum. All the multiplicity of the world is simply the maximum being that has contracted itself, without itself becoming changed or limited in any way. Cusa talks about this in terms of enfolding and unfolding. All of creation in its vast multiplicity and diversity is enfolded in God, and God is unfolded as the multiplicity of the universe. Quote, God, therefore, is the enfolding of all things in the sense that all are in God, and God is the unfolding of all things in the sense that God is in all. So we end up with a view of the world that's quite interesting in the way that it paradoxically affirms similarity and difference at the same time, just like so many of the other great mystics. God is transcendent of all things and is none of them, because God cannot be limited to any one thing in opposition to another, which is how individual things are conceived, as we said. But God is also the maximum that has become contracted into all multiplicity, the latter of which has God as its fundamental identity, in a sense, at the same time. This leads him also to interesting discussions on, like, nominalism versus universalism. So even though he generally is very close to the Neoplatonists, as we see, in this sense, in this topic, he seems to fall more in line with Aristotle and earlier thinkers like Duns Scotus. So he argues that only particulars exist, right? There are no universal concepts that exist out there, but only particular beings. There are no universals that have reality outside of the mind's abstraction of them. But at the same time, each particular expresses universal principles latent in the possibility of the unfolding itself, with each such universal really being a potential in the one unity of the absolute maximum that is God. So the essence of humanity or tableness is not an existent universal out there somewhere, but those essences are united in God and are expressed in multiplicity. So in a sense, he combines Aristotelianism and Neoplatonism here because he also seemed to argue that there's a kind of hierarchy of contraction, with things becoming more particularized, going down this chain of being from genus to species and then individual that species and so on, right? There's this, as the maximum contracts itself, it seems to do so in stages, in more and more sort of complexity and multiplicity. So there's a kind of Neoplatonic chain of being, but he also is more Aristotelian and peripatetic in the sense that he denies the independent reality of universals, which is kind of a very key aspect of at least a lot of Platonism. Now, because the world is the contraction or unfolding of God, it also retains a certain likeness to God, so that it can be said to be the appearance of God in limited form, the invisible become visible. Quote, "Who could understand how all things, though different contingently, are the image of that single infinite form, as if the creature were an occasioned God, just as an accident is an occasioned substance and a woman an occasioned man? The infinite form is received only in a finite way. Consequently, every creature is, as it were, a finite infinity or a created God, so that it exists in the way in which this could best be. It is as if the Creator had spoken, let it be made, and because God, who is eternity itself, could not be made, that was made which could be made, which would be as much like God as possible." Perhaps we can use the imagery of the light and a kind of rainbow, or a light and the prism, which basically is a metaphor that Kuza himself also uses in On Learned Ignorance later on, I think in book 3. Of course, not the prism one, but the rainbow one, saying that there's one light, but it becomes contracted, or it appears as this multiplicity of color. And the colors are all different from the light. They cannot be said to be identical. But at the same time, the colors are nothing but the being of the light that's become refracted in multiplicity, right? So this is kind of maybe one way of thinking of at least one aspect of what he is saying here. There's, of course, a lot more that we can explore when it comes to his vision and all that he says in these works, but you'll have to explore for yourself his writings to really get into some of the juicy details of his incredibly complex thought. But one other point that might be good to bring up here, of course, since he is a Christian, is how he brings in the doctrine of the Trinity into this whole situation, as well as the person and role of Christ, of Jesus, in this scheme. And indeed, the third book of On Learned Ignorance, it's divided into three books. So the first one is like arguing for this maximum God as the maximum, and our ignorance to knowing God and the coincidence of opposites. The second book is dedicated to the world, like what is the world in relationship to God, what is multiplicity in relationship to unity, the world as the contracted maximum. And the third book is dedicated to Jesus, to Christ, as being this reality that unites the absolute maximum and the contracted maximum. Now, in terms of the Trinity, he understands God as not just a static unity, but as a more vibrant, as a kind of dynamic God, in a sense, in which the Trinity obviously plays a very important role because he's a Christian. And he understands the Trinity. This might be a difficult topic to summarize very briefly, but one way that he describes it is that within God, there's always a kind of triune relationship, a triune dynamic, so that the Father is unity, the Son is equality, and the Holy Spirit is the connection between them. In another place, he describes it as God is the potential for uniting. The Son is that which can be united. And the Holy Spirit, once again, is like the connection that allows them to unite. There's a beautiful also section in another work, which we'll get to soon, called On the Vision of God, where he talks about this in terms of love. And he actually gets very close to Sufi metaphysics and the school of love within Sufism, because he talks about the Trinity and God as love. God is love itself, infinite love. And because that which, you know, the lovableness of God is infinite, he's infinitely lovable, there has to be someone who is infinitely loving of God. And that creates this relationship of God, of Father as that which is infinitely loving, the Son as that which is infinitely lovable, and the Holy Spirit as the love in which that relationship is realized. So this is a really interesting way. Of course, it's quite different from that Sufi version. In that section, love is at the top. But it's very interesting, a very beautiful way of expressing it. And also, he claims that this kind of relationship between, you know, the potential, the recipients, and their connection, we can see this in all of reality and all of creation in general. See this divine reality reflected in this reality. In terms of Jesus or Christ, Kuza is quite unique in how he fits him into the system. Obviously, he assumes, you know, Chalcedonian orthodoxy about Jesus' role in salvation and his divine and human nature, but he conceived him as both contracted maximum and absolute maximum, united fully in one being. Remember that all created things, including human beings, are contracted beings. They are the absolute maximum that has become contracted into a limited appearance and form. And to be maximum in an absolute sense would mean being the most full realization of pure being, which is not possible for a limited contracted thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't be contracted anymore. Except for one. There is one unique contracted maximum, which is also the absolute maximum, and thereby unites the absolute with the contracted, and that being is Jesus. So this works for Christian orthodoxy, since it is the Son that, in a sense, brings union between humans and God, and who, through his death and resurrection, offers spiritual immortality and eternal life to all humans. It's complex stuff, but really fascinating, really interesting. And I recommend, again, going through his works yourself more thoroughly to really sort of get all the details and arguments that he gives for this theology and Christology. Now, Kuza obviously uses language and concepts to point us to something that's supposedly beyond concepts. And he is, at least in my opinion, remarkably good at it, as well as being very innovative. Indeed, while he argues that no names are really appropriate to God, since, like, for example, to say that God is good seems to limit God because you're saying God is good, which excludes every other quality than goodness from God. So it's not really appropriate to give him any name because any name would be limiting. This is at least part of his argument here. Despite this, he does play around a lot in his later writings, especially by like inventing new names for God that point to God's nature in some way. For example, in a work called De Possessed, he coins a new word, the one in the title, possessed, as a name for God, which is an amalgamation of two words, posse, meaning possible or potential, and est, meaning simply is. So the possessed, indicates that God is pure potentiality, right? But a potentiality that simultaneously is always fully actual. Complete potential and complete actuality in one and the same concept or name. Similarly, in another work from the same period called De Non Aliud, On the Not Other, he applies to God the name, you guessed it, Not Other. This is really just another way of saying what he has been saying the whole time about God being the maximum, which is all that it can possibly be, which, as we saw, had the necessary result that God cannot be other than anything. Hence, he is, per definition, the not other. He must have had some fun while writing this work, because he offers us beacons of rhetoric clarity, such as this famous quote, "Not other is not another, nor is it other than any other, nor is it an other in another, for no other reason than that it is not other, which can in no way be other, as if something were lacking to it, as to another. For an other which is other than something lacks that than which it is other, but not other, because it is not other than anything, does not lack anything, nor can anything be outside it. This might have just given you a headache. I know it did for me the first time, but it actually makes total sense given everything that we've said so far. God must be not other, because if it was other than anything, it would be lacking by not being that other thing. But the maximum and not other cannot be lacking, because it is per definition that which is all that it can be. So it has to be not other than all things. Because we can never know God as such, the only way to experience God or know God is by transcending knowing itself. To go beyond the concepts of the mind and resting in pure learned ignorance, or unknowing, as Pseudo-Dionysius calls it. Quote, "These considerations can assist the intellect, and by the likeness of the infinite line, the intellect can in sacred ignorance move greatly forward, above all understanding, toward the simply maximum. For here we have now seen clearly how we arrive at God by removing the participation of beings. For all beings participate in being. Therefore, if participation is removed from all things, there remains simplest being itself, which is the essence of all things. It is only in learned ignorance that we behold such being, for when I mentally remove all the things that participate being, nothing seems to remain. For this reason, the great Dionysius says that an understanding of God approaches nothing rather than something. But sacred ignorance teaches me that what seems nothing to the intellect is the incomprehensible maximum." But despite this, Nicholas continued experimenting with words and concepts like this until he died, basically. And indeed, scholars like H. Lawrence Bond argues that it is in his very final work, the Apice Theorae, On the Summit of Contemplation, that we get the most mature and developed form of his wider vision, where he seems to prefer to refer to God simply as posse ipsum, or posse, or potential, possibility itself. The work in question is a dialogue between himself and his secretary, Peter, who asks Nicholas about a new insight that he has had as a result of a long contemplation during Easter weekend. Nicholas replies that he, just as everyone else, is seeking the what, the true whatness of all things. And the conclusion that he has come to is that the what of all is posse itself, and now claims that if God can be named, this would be the best name. Because all things are posse, possibility. Nothing can be without first being posse, and everything thus only expresses or is the appearance of posse. But importantly, he has concluded that within the vast diversity of things in the world, things don't have separate whatness or posse, but everything only has a single whatness, a single potential, which is posse itself. H. Lawrence Bond says, quote, "The dialogue propounds a final lesson in theoria or contemplation. It is the lesson of introspection, of seeing within, of paying careful attention to what and how the mind sees in vari sentibus, what and how it sees as it sees in the various beings. This is not a simple transcendent vision, although it is a simple vision. This is introspection. The mind sees intra what is invisible to sensory sight. It sees the invisible in the visible and sees the posse in the esse. It sees in various beings that which they can be and that which they can have only in posse itself. In so doing, the mind sees the various modes of appearance of posse itself and not posse itself as visible. As the whatness of things, posse itself cannot be various, so what the mind sees is posse itself appearing variously. But does the mind through introspection or contemplation see posse itself? No and yes. It does not see posse itself as itself, but neither does the mind see posse itself only in an image or in an enigma or darkness. What does the mind see at the pinnacle of sight? It sees posse itself, but only as it manifests itself, only as it appears in things, or in beings, or in powers, or in posse, and only when the mind sees in them only posse itself, that is, only when the mind sees in them nothing except posse itself. What this leads to for Nicholas is a kind of change from his more pure negative theology and learned ignorance to a more positive theology where we can see God. We do see posse itself in all things. Everything is beaming with the light of the divine to us. Quote, "You will then see that various beings are only various modes of appearance of posse itself, but that their whatness cannot be various because it is posse itself appearing variously." To see things is to see posse, to see pure potentiality, of which they are only appearances without ever changing the unity of the pure underlying essence of possibility. If we can learn to see things, we'll be able to see the invisible in the visible, to see the unity in its apparent multiplicity, to see God in all appearance, not as identical to them in a pantheistic sense, but as the pure one potentiality that is the being and reality of all, and simultaneously none of them, and indeed nothing at all. And perhaps nowhere is this more apparent than in the mind, the posse of which is simply a reflection of posse itself. If the mind can see itself, recognize itself as another appearance of, and thus the same as, posse itself, then we enter a vision of seeing and being seen at the same time, with the same vision, which perhaps reminds us of Eckhart's famous saying that the eye with which I see God is the same eye with which God sees me. This certainly comes off as quite mystical, right? Quote unquote mystical. And that's actually a good question to sort of ask ourselves and to get into next. Because when we talk about Kuza, or we read about Kuza, he's often described as a mystic. But is that actually an accurate title for him? Because so far, when we've been reading his works, he's primarily very philosophical, very theological. He's using rational language and even mathematics to talk about God. And it's not been so much about the mystical experience as such. Now, arguably, of course, you know, based on like Bernard McGinn's definition of mysticism, which is the definition that I generally prefer and like very much, which is that mysticism is, quote, belief and practices that concern the preparation for, the consciousness of, and the reaction to what can be described as the immediate or direct presence of God. Now, based on that definition, we can certainly argue that Kuza's writings are an example of the beliefs of and the reactions to that divine presence that is mentioned here. And also, certainly, if we go by Pseudo-Dionysius' mystical theology in that work and how he conceives of what the mystical is, then Kuza is doing essentially the exact same thing, even theoretically and philosophically, that Dionysius is referring to there. But do we find anything in him relating to the experiential dimension of mysticism, that consciousness of God's presence, or maybe even union with God that so many people associate with the term mysticism? Well, arguably, yes, and particularly in a beautiful work called The Visione Dei, On the Vision of God. This work was actually written in response to a request sent by the monks at a Benedictine monastery in Germany. They had read his works, but were a bit perplexed about his teachings, like that of the coincidence of opposites, for example, and thus requested him to give them an explanation, to explain these concepts further. And as a response to this, Kuza sent them a painted image of the divine face, probably some image of Christ, right, a kind of icon, sent them this image, this icon, along with this text on the vision of God. And the text is essentially instructions on how to use this image of the divine as a mode of contemplation and meditation on God, but also on these themes that he explores philosophically in other writings. So the work becomes a contemplation on how to use the image as a way of mystically seeing. He tries to give us a way of mystically seeing and being seen by God simultaneously. What he's doing here in this work is essentially using this image once again and arguing that you can meditate on this painted face and the fact that it is looking at you at all times. So this was likely, an image where the face was looking straight at the audience, right? Just like if you have a painting today or a photograph, when a person like me right now, I'm looking into the lens and you're looking at me, which means that I will be looking at you. Even if you move to another part of the room right now, you will still perceive me looking straight at you. So he uses this idea that you have this painting in the north of the room, and regardless if you stand on the east side of the room or the west side of the room, you will have this this sensation of the face looking at you directly. And even if you move across the room, you will find that the gaze of the image will follow you the whole time. And if there are multiple people in the room, the face is looking at all of them simultaneously, even if they are in different places. You know, this is maybe something we take for granted, but really, like when he describes it here, and you read it, you're kind of struck by how strange of a thing that actually is, even though there is a natural explanation, of course, but it's still like a weird experience. Anyway, he uses that and tells these monks to meditate on that, to use that as a way of recognizing that God, this is a kind of reflection of the fact that God is always seeing us and seeing all of us at the same time. And he says that because God is being itself, God is absolute being and the being of all things. So to exist is to be given being by God. And he also argues then that God's being is his seeing. So that to exist is to be seen by God. But when you really contemplate the situation, you realize that your seeing is also just existent through God's seeing as a contraction of that seeing. So when we see God, and our seeing is God seeing us, which also means that God seeing us is us seeing God as a single seeing and single awareness. He writes, quote, "O Lord, when you look upon me with an eye of graciousness, what is your seeing other than your being seen by me? In seeing me, you who are Deus absconditus, the hidden God, give yourself to be seen by me. No one can see you except insofar as you grant that you be seen. To see you is not other than that you see the one who sees you." This has profound implications and results mystically in a single seeing itself as the core activity of all reality. H. Lawrence Bond again beautifully summarizes it, quote, "Creatures exist not only by God's seeing, but also by seeing God." On the Vision of God is a beautiful work that is both philosophically rich, but also potent in sort of philosophical contemplation, meditation, to the point that it becomes, like just reading the work, the nature of how it is composed, just reading the words can become a meditation itself. It's a really interesting and beautiful work in that way. It's also not as dense in terms of the language as most of his other works. So if anyone is interested in getting into Kuza's writings, this might be maybe the best place to start. But Kuza wrote on more than just dense metaphysics and divine mathematics. All of these foundations also informed his more worldly work in terms of, you know, church reforms and even his calls for ecumenism. Indeed, there are some fascinating works where Nicholas engages directly with other faith communities, both within and outside of Christianity. The most profound of these came about as a direct response to the fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Muslims in 1453. This was, of course, both politically and symbolically a very dramatic event and would change world history down to our very own day. Constantinople, which had really been the center for Christianity and the Christian empire, so to say, for many periods of history, had fallen to the Muslims, who would rename it Istanbul, a name that it retains to this day. The response from the Christians in the rest of Europe was, of course, immediate. Many, including the Pope, called for a new crusade to be instigated to win back the city. Nicholas lived through all this as a high-standing person in the church. But his perspective and response was quite remarkable, especially for his time. Indeed, as a response to this event, he wrote a work called De Pace Fide, on the peace of faiths, which essentially argues for religious unity. This work is a fictive dialogue held in heaven between different groups of people representing different religious traditions, including an Arab and a Turkish man to represent Islam. And what it certainly seems that Nicholas is doing in this work is, rather than the polemical approach that most earlier Christians had had against other religions, he seems to aim to find common ground in different ways, not just with other Christians of other denominations, but even with the Muslims. At the core of the dialogue seems to be an idea that he refers to in Latin as una religio in ritum varietate, one religion in the variety of rites. What he means by this, or rather the implications of this idea, has been debated by scholars. In some ways, it seems to be a natural extension of his philosophy, because God is not only unknown, but the maximum of which all things are simply the unfolding appearances, that could lead one to argue that everyone is indeed worshipping God, or follows the same religion at the core, but that they have formed different outer rites and expressions for this core. A kind of unity and multiplicity idea, right? Quote, "If you will deign to do the foregoing, the sword will cease, as will also the malice of hatred and all evils. And all men will know that there is only one religion in a variety of rites. But perchance this difference of rites cannot be eliminated, or perhaps it is not expedient that it be eliminated in order that the diversity may make for an increase of devotion, since each region will devote more careful attention to making its ceremonies more favorable, as it were, to you, the king. If so, then at least let there be one religion, just as you are one, and one true worship of you as sovereign." Other scholars argue that what he's doing is quite different. And while we might agree that such a reading of the philosophical or ontological basis of the idea might be sound and in line with what Kuza is doing, in a more practical sense, it isn't what you might think. This is not, by most accounts, an argument for complete religious pluralism or relativism. Clearly, Nicholas saw Christianity and his understanding of Roman Catholicism in particular as the true faith and religion of mankind. He isn't saying that all religions or rites are equal because they all express a common core. Christ as Savior and all the implications that this has in terms of the doctrine of the Trinity, etc., is the true religion to him. I find no good reason to read him in any other way than having this as a foundation. In Unlearned Ignorance, he writes, quote, "Unless I am not mistaken, you see that there is no perfect religion leading to the final and most desired end of peace that does not embrace Christ as mediator and savior, God and human, the way, the truth, and the life." But he does open up for discussion and dialogue in order to find commonalities within outer differences. Christianity might be the ultimate truth, but other religions or rites in this language are also expressions of that one core religion, that one faith and relationship with God, and will thus also express certain truths, that unity hiding behind multiplicity. No words or definitions can ever capture God, and neither can any rite or historically emergent doctrine or religion, but simultaneously, they can all express that hidden unity and, importantly, the human striving to have a relationship with it. Quote, "Aid us then, O you who alone are able to, for this strife occurs for the sake of you, whom alone all men worship in everything they are seen to adore. For no one in whatever he is seen to desire, desires anything except the good which you are. And in all intellectual inference, no one seeks anything other than the truth which you are. What does that which is alive seek except to continue living? What does that which exists seek except to continue existing? You then, who are the giver of life and of existence, are the one who is seen to be sought in different ways, in different rites, and you are named in different names. For as you are in yourself, you remain unknown and ineffable to all." And rather than arguing for a pure dogmatic exclusivism or arguing for violent conflict, the purpose of Kuza's dialogue is expressly to reach peace through recognizing the commonalities and the unity underlying all religion, as he expresses quite clearly in the very opening paragraph of the work. Quote, "Therefrom he adduced the following. The few wise men who are rich in the experiential knowledge of all such differences, as are observed throughout the world in the different religions, can find a single, readily available harmony. And through this harmony, there can be constituted, by a suitable and true means, perpetual peace within the domain of religion. Hence, in order that this vision might one day become known to those who have a say in these especially important matters, he wrote down plainly in what follows as much of it as he recalled." Regardless of how one interprets the actual core purpose of what he's trying to do in this text, and what he means by this one religion, many rites idea, it's quite clear that the purpose at least is to open up for discussion, right? To find peace in this very violent period when a lot of things were happening, you know, the conquest of Constantinople. His response to that was very much in opposition to many other people who the direct response was to militarily, with violence, go and get the city back. He seems to be trying to reach peace through discussion, right? And this becomes clear also when we read certain of his letters that he sent back and forth with one of his friends at that time, where he expresses this very same idea. Essentially that the response to the Ottomans should not be violence, but dialogue. A dialogue where he obviously hoped that, you know, the result would be that the Muslims came to see the truth of Christianity and would become Christians, right? So it's, again, it's not like a pure religious pluralism at work here, but still a dialogue rather than conflict. And I think this is quite admirable and quite interesting for, especially again, for his time and place. Interestingly, though, this position seems to have maybe changed over time, as he might have become less optimistic about the possibilities of this dialogue. By the 1460s, as Pope Pius II called for a crusade, Nicholas seems to have gradually supported this proposition. He was also tasked by the Pope to aim at the Muslims through polemics as well, by writing a critical commentary on their holy scripture, the Quran. And Nicholas did in fact write this commentary in the form of a work called Cribratio al Qurani, or Sifting the Quran. Part of what's so interesting about this work is that it has a kind of double approach. On the one hand, it's a polemical work aiming to show that Muhammad was a false or at least misguided prophet. Kuza is actually quite harsh on Muhammad in the text, saying that he, quote, sought not the glory of God and the salvation of men, but rather his own glory. On the other hand, the second purpose of the book is to actually use what he calls faithful interpretation, pia interpretatio, when reading the Quran, which means that he aims to use the Quran to confirm the teachings of the Gospels. This is based on an assumption that there must be some truth in the Quran, right? Perhaps truth that has been inspired by God in some way, but that is mixed with untruth because of the limits of Muhammad or anyone who isn't Christ. Quote, suppose it were the case that they, the prophets like Muhammad or Moses, disclosed certain words that had been infused into them, words which symbolized or signified God and the way unto him. Still, neither Moses nor Muhammad nor any other man would have been able to explain the meanings of these words. And if some man would have been able or would be able to manifest this way, then assuredly he would have to have been the greatest of all men, even as all nations acknowledge the Messiah to be. So Kuza takes the position that the Quran does contain certain truths, truths that might even be inspired directly by God, but that it is also mixed with untruth. And he gives two explanations for this, two possible explanations. Either this is the result of ignorance on the part of Muhammad, as he seems to describe here, right? That Muhammad wasn't able to fully grasp and thus expound these divine messages, and thus misled people through this misunderstanding. Or the other option, which is that Muhammad was actively misguiding people on purpose through malicious intent, basically. And it's not entirely clear, but it seems that Nicholas mostly goes by the first alternative. That he seems to imply that it's mostly ignorance that is the cause of this. As such, he states his purpose of the sifting of the Quran as, quote, having presupposed the gospel of Christ to scrutinize the book of Muhammad and to show that even in it there are contained those teachings through which the gospel would be altogether confirmed, were it in need of confirmation, and that wherever the Quran disagrees with Christ, this disagreement has resulted from Muhammad's ignorance. In any case, this approach of faithful interpretation leads to some really interesting interpretations and readings of the Quranic text. He is actively seeking out the truth of the gospel, to confirm the gospel, of course, but also possibly in what is still an effort to reach Muslims and build some kind of bridge to them through this dialogue. There is, again, a lot that one can go through and bring up when it comes to this Quranic commentary, and there's no time to do it all here, but it is available in translation if anyone is interested. One thing that stands out to me to really showcase this approach of faithful interpretation is his interpretation and reading of the Quranic verses that talks about the Trinity. Because Islam, and of course thus the Quran, is very critical of the Trinity, because Islam has as a principle a much stricter monotheism. Right? God is one,